widely read. But she's also written a collection of short stories, and she comes from a family of no money and writes a lot about her life growing up in an impoverished white community. And so the River of Names is a story, if you're interested, that, how to characterize it? It sort of is a meditation on family members, cousins, some siblings, uncles and aunts, who have disappeared from her community, and nobody knows how or why. They know some of the situations. You know, some of them died in car accidents due to alcohol, and some of them committed suicide, and some of them, I think, you know, moved away, but nobody knows where they ended up. It's a difficult story, and the list of names is long. Mm-hmm. And so there's this dark power to the nature of the story, and because it's sort of these little vignettes of a lot of different people that she knew, it helps raise a reader's awareness to sort of the variety of hurdles and emotional and material lack and damage, I guess. So, I don't know. The way these sessions have been going, though, I always run out of time to read selections from the stories, and I think some of the interactive work we've been doing has been most interesting and productive, so I just figured we would focus this hour on an activity. I think that on Monday, perhaps, I read a little bit of this article on white privilege. I'm going to back up and sort of reread, because there's an article written by a woman who is on the faculty at Wellesley College. She wrote this article in 1988 called White Privilege, Unpacking the Invisible Backpack. And I'm going to read the opening paragraphs to her article and then a few examples from a very long list she includes about her own privileges based on skin color that she's aware of in her life. You know, because I'm white, I don't get harassed when I go shopping in certain kinds of stores. You know, these kinds of things. What's fascinating is that a lot of people read this article, and it has spawned a lot of analogs. You know, there are people reflecting on black male privilege, heterosexual privilege, white male privilege. I think I had with me yesterday some ability privileges, etc. So you can actually, on your own, find these lists. They're all over the web, and you can just type in, you know, whichever privilege checklist, and these things will come up. They're sort of out there and disseminated, and they make really great tools for having conversations in your own communities or in a church environment or something. And I really think it is one of the most important fundamental tasks toward figuring out what to do if we feel like we are people who want to care about a diverse world and our task in it, you know, what we're called to do to be members of a diverse community. I've sort of joked all along, those of you who haven't been in a session yet, but I began the week and reiterated that it's not my goal just to say, oh, diversity is great, and here are all these different kinds, and isn't everyone wonderful, and aren't we all lucky to be in this privileged culture? That sounds really nice, and you know, that's a great idea in a way. The problem is that diversity in our social fabric at this point in time comes along with power differentials all over the place. There's a very complex set of power hierarchies that are interwoven. And it's not quite that there's just a single ladder, you know, with the people on the bottom and the people on the top, but there are all kinds of intersections among them. And so I think it's really necessary for anyone to reflect first on our own opportunities and our own privileges in order to help us answer the question, how do we make a difference in the lives of others? I think it's fairly easy to acknowledge there are oppressed people in our world, right? Really difficult, I don't know what I would have to say to you if you thought that there were world oppressed categories of people. I might just have to ask you to leave. I don't know. I don't know. What do you do with that? But what is much harder than acknowledging that there are oppressed categories is acknowledging the inverse. That means that there are people with undue privilege on the opposite side of those oppressed categories, and especially when that's us, that's uncomfortable. And it's far more difficult to have a conversation about white privilege, about male privilege. You know, people get really uncomfortable, and they don't want to sort of realize that anything for the privileged category might have to change. If anything's going to change about the oppressed categories and opportunities for people to be viewed in a more humane fashion, then there are implications for the people in the position of privilege, and that's uncomfortable.
Yeah.
I like the privileges that I have, and I care about people who have fewer than I in a lot of different ways. But it is complicated, even for the most well-meaning among us, I think, to really take seriously the implications that it might have. Nobody wants to feel like I am losing power in some power structure. And everyone gets defensive about the idea that someone's taking away my power, you know. But how else does power realign? If we know that some people don't have as much, you know, there has to be some implication there. So what I thought I'd do for today, I'm just going to read you Peggy McIntosh's sort of intro, setting up why she decided to make a white privilege checklist. And I'm going to read a couple examples from her list, and then I'm just going to read a couple examples from these other lists that I just copied these off the web. I noted where they're from. I did the right thing. And you can look these up on the web too. And I thought I'd put you into groups of maybe three or four people and give you a little bit of time to brainstorm about some additional ways that you feel like you can articulate that you have privilege along any sort of power line. And I thought we'd just make a list of things that we come up with on our own that we haven't talked about yet, and then the task for the remainder of our time is just to brainstorm together about what are the implications. Does anyone have practical, immediate, you know, sort of having a global awareness but thinking locally, acting locally? What do we do? Because I think that's, you know, the most practical thing, to leave this place or to leave a discussion like this feeling like we have the agency to do something. And that's a hard question to answer. I don't have the answers, so don't leave here in a huff if an hour goes by and I have not given you the tools. Today in particular, I just want us to sort of build some conversation together. Any thoughts at the moment? So, Peggy McIntosh, I'll just read a handful of these paragraphs. She begins her article, Unpacking the Invisible Knapsack of White Privilege, with a quotation. I was taught to see racism only in individual acts of meanness, not in invisible systems conferring dominance on my group. I think that might be true for a lot of us, you know. We can, I think, I take that back. There are times when we can identify a racist act and say, oh, that's bad. That shouldn't have happened. This is obscene. But that's not the only thing that's going on, individual people being mean to one another. There are systemic ideologies that are shaping us all the time, and they are invisible, and this is why they're insidious. Because we can be the best intentioned people, but not know quite the fullness of what's going on. So she says, through my work to bring materials from gender studies into the rest of our curriculum at Wellesley, I have often noticed men's unwillingness to grant that they are overprivileged, even though they may grant that women are disadvantaged. Again, this dynamic. they may say they will work to right this imbalance in society, in the university, or in the curriculum, but they can't or won't support the idea of lessening their place. Denials that amount to taboos surround the subject of advantages that men gain from women's disadvantages. These denials protect male privilege from being fully acknowledged, lessened, or ended. I taught at Grinnell College in Iowa for 1 year, and there was a gentleman in the English department who had been there for a very long time. I don't know if you know Grinnell's reputation. It's a very fine private liberal arts college in the middle of a cornfield, and one of the more diverse undergraduate populations in the country. They have a lot of money. Warren Buffett is the source of their bankroll. He's given a lot of money to the school, so they have a very large endowment. And it was a wonderful place to work, but my department was doing a search for a long-term position that was not in my field. I was there for a year, but I couldn't apply for the long-term position. But I was in on all the conversations and got to go to the candidate interviews and be part of this conversation. And the oldest member of the department, really bright, really warm gentleman, brought up, there were two male candidates for the job and one female candidate for the job. And in one conversation, somewhat out of the blue, he said, "Well, we're going to need to look at these two male candidates because they have families to support." And I just thought, what decade am I in? I have traveled through time somehow to some strange place. And Grinnell in particular was the strangest place to be because of all of its diversity. And I don't know, I was just like, really? Are we really having that conversation? But somehow there was this idea that a man is the breadwinner. Mm-hmm. And so if we have two candidates of equal worth to us as a community, let's support the one who needs the money, who apparently is the man. So these are these moments where invisibly, this female candidate had no idea that she might be disadvantaged in this way, and it had nothing to do with her skills or abilities or background or research or rapport with the students at all. It was quite a fascinating little moment, very recent. So this is the kind of context, even at a bright college with bright people, that we're dealing with. So McIntosh continues, "Thinking through unacknowledged male privilege as a phenomenon, I realized that since hierarchies in our society are interlocking, there was most likely a phenomenon of white privilege that was similarly denied and protected. As a white person, I realized I had been taught about racism as something that puts others at a disadvantage, but had been taught not to see one of its corollary aspects, white privilege, which puts me at an advantage. I think whites are carefully taught not to recognize white privilege, as males are taught not to recognize male privilege. So I have begun in an untutored way to ask what it is like to have white privilege. I've come to see white privilege as an invisible package of unearned assets that I can count on cashing in each day, but about which I was, quote unquote, meant by the system to remain oblivious. White privilege is like an invisible, weightless knapsack of special provisions, maps, passports, code books, visas, clothes, tools, and blank checks. Describing white privilege makes one newly accountable. As we work to reveal privilege in many categories, we must ask, having described privilege, what will I do to lessen or end it?" So this is the model for our conversation. Blah, 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 blah. So here are just a couple examples from her white privilege checklist. "I can, if I wish, arrange to be in the company of people of my race most of the time. I can avoid spending time with people whom I was trained to mistrust and who have learned to mistrust my kind. When I am told about our national heritage or about civilization, I am shown that people of my color made it what it is." Right or wrong, right? That's a crazy error in some ways. I can be sure that my children will be given curricular materials that testify not only to the existence, but to the success and possibly even to the superiority of their race. Possibly even, really. This one's a good one. If I want to, I can be pretty sure of finding a publisher for this piece on white privilege. Let's see. I can be pretty sure of having my voice heard in a group in which I am the only member of my race. Whether I use checks, credit card, or cash, I can count on my skin color not to work against the appearance of financial responsibility. I do not have to educate my children to be aware of systemic racism for their own daily physical protection. I am never asked to speak for all the people of my racial group. How absurd would that be? What do white people think on this topic? Well, about a million bajillion things, you know. But how often do we notice that people in those marked categories rather than the unmarked subjects are invited somehow to do that? You know, what do gay people think about these laws in these countries?
Wow.
Well, I don't know. I know what a couple people might think because I've had some conversations, but what do they think? Just a couple others here to get our thoughts going. I can swear or dress in secondhand clothes or not answer letters without having people attribute these choices to the bad morals, the poverty, or the illiteracy of my race. You know, you just think about, you know, sometimes you can try on in your mind's eye putting the same clothes on a different person and realize that there would be very different interactions or assumptions made. And that is startling. There's a very long list here, and I'm going to hand this over to one of your small groups. I don't know if this was the next one to come out. There's actually a lot of scholarship on white privilege and a lot of these topics. This isn't a new idea. Peggy McIntosh was writing in 1988, and so there's been a ton of much more attention. You can find scholarly work and studies on power and privilege in lots of places, so that's lucky for us. But these are sort of seminal touchstone pieces that got us thinking. There's a gentleman who wrote a male privilege checklist, and I want to just itemize a couple things that he says in his preface to his male privilege checklist. He says, pointing out that men are privileged in no way denies that bad things happen to men. Being privileged does not mean men are given everything in life for free. Being privileged does not mean that men do not work hard or do not suffer. In many cases, from a boy being bullied in school to a soldier dying in war, a sexist society that maintains male privilege also does great harm to men and boys. I think this is an insight that is true about any category. Any group that is exerting power to differentiate between themselves and another group is limiting both, and not just one. This writer goes on, several critics have argued that my list somehow victimizes women. I disagree. Pointing out problems is not the same thing as perpetuating them. I think this is a really important insight for any of these conversations on sort of vulnerable, dicey issues to talk about with one another. Oftentimes, one can be accused of perpetuating power imbalances because you are talking about them. But this is one of the insidious ways that the invisibility dynamic functions. If you're the one who brings up trying to make visible a power differential, that accusation can come in. What are you doing? You know, you're just sort of reinforcing, you know, to say that women don't get to do this or get hired less or whatever. Isn't that just maintaining this thing we're all supposed to be fighting against? Well, how do we fight against something we aren't really looking at square in the eye? That's what I think. So this guy is writing things like, my odds of being hired for a job when competing against female applicants are probably skewed in my favor. Yes. Not necessarily. This depends a lot on context, depends on who you're working for, who's making those decisions, right? But that can be true. My own experience just a couple years ago suggests that. This man says, if I have children but do not provide primary care for them, my masculinity will not be called into question. Whether you're the best parent or dad you could be might be called into question. There's certainly issues there, but your manhood is not the problem. And if you think, do you know women who have given up the primary care of their children? Wow, that's a big problem for a lot of people. You know, what kind of a woman is she to do that? So, my elected representatives are mostly people of my own sex. The more prestigious and powerful the elected position, the more this is true. Data still supports this. And there are a lot of implications of that. A lot of things we should be thinking about with the people making laws, making decisions. If as you go up the scale of power, there are fewer women, it's not that, again, women are all going to say the same thing or all going to think the same way. Lord knows we know that. But if we are nevertheless looking at gender for the moment, there's skewed data out there. I believe that one of the most startling statistics I had students look up in the last year, a group was doing work on ownership and money and gender. And I think the number they discovered, and I haven't done corroborating this, I have to just put out a caveat, this is student work. But globally, out of the saleable land available in the globe, does anyone want to guess what percent of it is owned by women?
Three.
One, three, any other numbers?
Five.
One, three, five. Wow, we're all pretty optimistic. Woo! Yeah. All the way up to 5%? Who are you, man?
What?
It is 3. 3% of the land that can be owned or sold or whatever. I guess we're not talking about little spots of the Sahara or something like that. But if you think in our culture, in the United States, in the 21st century, what it is to be a landowner and how, owning real estate, even in the frightening real estate broken bubble that we've been living in the last few years, we still have been groomed to think that owning land is one of the central valuable things. Yeah, and it probably still is. Yeah.
Even in the ELCA, there hasn't been a female bishop elected since 2007. And we talked about that in the bishop spouse gathering. And it's amazing how the bishops don't see that as a problem.
Huh.
And then there was speculation about, the tougher times are, the more we look to males for leadership.
Oh.
And I'm thinking, even in our own church structure, we're not getting women. There's still a glass ceiling. So.
Wow.
I mean, it's not just kind of out there. It's right here.
Yeah.
Where we live.
So. Wow. Yeah, and this is what fascinates me. This doesn't call into question exactly the virtues of male bishops.
Right.
I'm sure they're
nice guys,
gifted good men who are there doing their work. So having this conversation isn't about accusing the male bishopric of somehow screwing with us. Nevertheless, there are some issues that come along with not having as many voices of difference in those conversations. Mm-hmm. So this begs the question for us, what do we do? What do any of us do if we have become more aware of this data and sort of how things are skewed in various categories, rather than just feel powerless or like, oh my God, which sometimes I feel like just going, oh my God.
Yeah.
We're all insane. I don't know, what does anybody do? But if you get in that mindset, you might as well not get out of bed in the morning. So one has to just think optimistically and think creatively and try to figure out, okay, in my day, if I get out of bed this morning, what might I do? What might I say to someone? What might I bring up and to whom will I choose to converse today? And what will I say in those conversations? So I'll just take a couple more minutes, a couple examples from the heterosexual checklist, the abilities checklist, and then we'll have you do a little bit more just brainstorming in groups. So here's a heterosexual privilege checklist. And this is from a blog from 2008. And there is a blog spot called Queers United. A few years old. On a daily basis as a straight person, I can be pretty sure that my roommate, hallmates, and classmates will be comfortable with my sexual orientation. Handy, that. If I pick up a magazine, watch TV, or play music, I can be certain that my sexual orientation will be represented. I did not grow up with games that attack my sexual orientation. How many of you played Smear the Queer in elementary school?
Oh, my gosh.
And pardon the language, but did anybody play fag tag?
What is it?
Fag tag?
No.
Younger generations a little bit. I don't know quite if what's regional or whatever, but yeah, games people play. God bless the playground. Aren't children innocent and beautiful? Wow. If I am, as a straight person, I am not accused of being abused, warped, or psychologically confused because of my sexual orientation. I can go home from most meetings, classes, and conversations without feeling excluded, fearful, attacked, isolated, outnumbered, unheard, held at a distance, stereotyped, or feared because of my sexual orientation. As a straight person, I am never asked to speak for everyone who is heterosexual. Again, right? That would be absurd. So we have to be careful about what we ask people to speak to, no matter who they are. As a straight person, people don't ask me why I made my choice of sexual orientation. When was that you were straight? What was that about? What caused you to come to that conclusion? People don't ask why I made my choice to be public about my sexual orientation. Different level of conversation there, but an important one. People of my gender do not try to convince me to change my sexual orientation. I can easily find a religious community that will not exclude me for being heterosexual. Mm-hmm. It's a long time Lutheran. This is a thing that I think about. Mm-hmm. I'm welcome now. It's awesome. Just for like the last 18 months. I was voted. Voted good somehow, or voted able to contribute. I thought I was going to contribute when I was 18. I was going to follow in the path of my beloved grandfather, Morris Wee, who is the greatest person on the planet, as far as I was concerned. But the church didn't want me, so that was a very strange thing for coming from a very tight-knit, very knitted to the institution of the Lutheran Church kind of family. It's like, really? Pretty sure I can sing the liturgy in tune better than everyone has ever been at the pulpit in my little church. all right, more things on that list. I think I read a few things from the upper class privilege checklist, but I'll just remind us a few of these things. In my community as a person of wealth, I am trusted and not perceived as a threat. Well, look how far trusting wealthy people gets us once in a while. Yeah. But, you know, we know that there's kind of that different level somehow that we give to the person in the business suit than we do others. As a wealthy person, I have the freedom to waste. I can be as private as I choose to be. One can choose to be private or choose not to be, but that's not a choice for some people. I can take vacations when and where I want. I can find myself at Holden Village, even if it feels like a stretch. We all got here. It takes money and time to get here. I do not have to worry about how emergencies will impact my spending requirements. You know, I live in a community where there are all kinds of vet hospitals, and I was driving just a couple days before coming up here, I drove by a pet eye clinic. And I was fascinated by that. It was the first time I'd ever seen that, and I thought, who has money to go like get their dog cataract surgery? Like, and if you have that money, you know, I'm really attached to my pets, but wow, you know, what? How could you could impact the lives of some other human beings? I don't know. That was very strange to me. Pet eye clinic. That was a new one. Yeah. Quick remark. There is a journalist named Jewel who writes a blog online, and he's an African-American man. And this is from a 2008 project also. And he notes, he says, what does privilege have to do with black men? We understand some kinds of privilege, the privilege to call a black man boy, even if that black man happens to be 60 years old or older, the privilege to drive a car and never have to worry that the police will racially profile you, right? This seems to marginalize black men, and I think it's easy for us who try to be thoughtful, open people to worry over the status and attitudes toward African-American men in our culture. But he is thinking through the complexity of nevertheless being a man as opposed to being an African-American woman or a woman of any race. So here's where we have this overlapping set of things. And so he's saying, you know, rather than just think about all the ways in which we are underprivileged or having assumptions made, you know, here are some privileges that he's thinking about. I don't have to choose my race over my sex in political matters. Right, that's, you know, that's an interesting thing. When I read African American history textbooks, I will learn mainly about black men. When I learn about the civil rights movement and the black power movements, most of the leaders that I will learn about will be black men. So we see the parallelism going on here that it is also useful to be aware of. There's categories on beauty. I don't have to worry about the daily hassles of having my hair conforming to any standard image of beauty the way black women do. You know, these are powerful gendered things, how much money somehow certain categories of people are. You know, expected is a weird word because then you want to think individually again and go, it's your money, your choice, what are you doing going to the hair salon every day or doing this or that. But this is the weird overlap between individual actions, like the racist act, and certain ideologies that impact all of us. Again, I end up talking longer than I intend to. I have 5 checklists here. I thought maybe we would just count off into 5s and group up with 3 or 4 people. I'm going to hand one of these lists to each of these groups. If you want to take a few minutes and read out a few more of them to one another just to cover some ground. But I'm definitely just interested in you generating for yourself some ideas that have popped into your head in the course of the week or in the course of half an hour about some places where you notice privilege that you maybe don't always think about. Okay? So, by 5s, so you start.
1, 2,
3, 4,
5,
1,
2, 3, 4, 5,
1,
2, 3, 4, 5,
1,
2, 3, 4,
5,
1,
2, 3.
Do you like to come 4. Be in a group or?
Sure.
no requirement.
That's right.
So I guess if you would just uplift yourselves and find one another, I don't really care where you end, just hold up numbers.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
It gets you to talk to some people you know a little less well.
2,
3,
4,
3, 4, 5,
three of us know each other.
That's true.
Oh, really?
So that was a discount. By number of chances of that happening.
Randy.
Randy, where are you from? We're all from Minnesota. Sure.
This list I've got, so the secondary pages.
I know.
In our local community. And through the entire time, there have only been four of us that have been members. And at our age, even I got elected. And I didn't know if it was my husband's position or if they thought it was mine. So when I started, I just thought, you know, the party goes down, but that's right here. I soon found out, men, and I can read all men ahead of time at the coffee shop. They know exactly how they're going to vote, and I don't know. And I asked for the name to jump. Then I realized everyone was up. So as soon as I started, they were running, it was right in the middle of them. I like that, but I didn't want to do that. They do. They vote out it. I could survive, and then I would respect them. But I knew my husband was very forward, not forward. So I really like his idea. I'm not really listening, you know, my mom. But I could tell quickly what their agenda was. I asked John about these kind of giveaways. But otherwise, they went home. And I think they appreciate that. They're only the second one to ever be Well, I knew that they voted for me. I had been vice president. And so I just thought, my unpopular things were going on. We were into financial,
I'm
So interesting. said that I have the privilege of walking through the airport.
I think I will invite you to sort of finish the part of my where you're on right now. Let us, in the interest of time, bring ourselves back to a large conversation. I know I'm interrupting good conversation in every direction right now. I guess it's my hope and assumption about these kinds of conversations that they will continue out the door and into lunch and into wherever you'd like. You don't have to resituate yourself. But hard to stop talking, it seems. Which is great.
Let us pray.
I guess that would shut everyone up. I'm not used to doing that in front of the groups that I work with. I'm happy to let someone of you, whoever wants to in your group, hang on to those sheets. I know where to get more copies, and you can bring them with you, share them with whomever you might want. So those can be tools, and you'll just know they're out there. And I do hope you will carry on conversation with one another and with others who aren't here today and back in your home communities in any way that seems useful. We have about 9 minutes to figure out what we're going to do. being people of privilege, I guess I'm just interested in brainstorming some possible specifics. In a given instance, I know you all talked about different experiences of being privileged. I'm not going to make that list on the board anymore, but I'm just curious what you're thinking about your own tasks, perhaps.
Well, and this just came to me about 2-3 months ago, so I've been trying it out.
Okay.
In the past, because I am very privileged, I have had people say, "You are so blessed." And that got into that prosperity theology that God loves me better, so I get wonderful grandchildren, a nice house, vacations, education, all those things.
God wants you to be wealthy.
Right, right. Wealthy, healthy, and wise, and all that. And so what I've started to say is when I'm saying something, I say, "I am privileged." And it usually stops because it sounds kind of like this, but it helps me remember that I am privileged. Nothing can stop me, basically, by prejudice. And the other thing that I've learned to do is in the Lord's Prayer to say, "Give me this day my daily bread," instead of "Give me this day my daily bread," because it's this day. And many people don't know when they get up in the morning what they will eat this day.
Mm-hmm.
So those are two things that I'm trying to get my head turned. And then whatever I do may come after that. But you got to get your head turned first.
Yeah. And one of the things I like about shifting that, you're so blessed or lucky or whatever words people put in, if you say back, "I'm privileged," it also helps them know that you are aware of certain categories of less privilege. And I think that's really important for those who feel marked and marginalized, because then you seem like an ally, perhaps. Yeah, thank you.
Privilege at times can be a disability because it gives you an unreal sense of yourself.
Uh-huh.
Who is that guy they said was born on third base and thought he hit a triple?
Yeah, I know which guy.
Yeah,
thinks he hit a triple, but there he was. Yeah, I mean, this is one of the limitations, the way that the invisibility limits us, gives us a very warped sense of what life is like.
Mm-hmm. I understand some of what's being said, but there's also an assumption here that in all areas it's a zero-sum game. It is, yes, there is power, and some people have power at the expense of others. But in some cases, like you having grandchildren doesn't take away from other people having
right.
grandchildren.
Yeah.
So yes, some mm-hmm. things are at the expense of others,
mm-hmm.
but some are. We all can enjoy it,
mm-hmm.
and then there's the whole herb experience. And the other thing is the idea of scarcity. Yes,
mm-hmm.
you know, and the idea of power, and you have and I don't.
Mm-hmm.
Scarcity is so a prevalent idea, but actually, we have enough. You know, it's wanting too much or never
mm-hmm.
being satisfied.
Mm-hmm.
In some ways, if it was more evenly distributed, we'd
mm-hmm.
all have enough.
Yeah.
So it's
mm-hmm.
interesting how there's, you know, there is that element of at my expense or your
mm-hmm.
expense, but then there's other things that we think are but really aren't.
But
there
I think it is other people's expense how I indulge my grandchildren or don't indulge them. I can buy them all kinds of wonderful things, or I can give the money to ELCA World Hunger.
Well,
so it does affect the rest of the world.
Well, how you act with it, but having them.
Yeah.
Oh, well.
Yeah.
Well, I think it's definitely privilege. And we get health care. We get nutritional diet. We get preschools and kindergartens and education. So, of course, our grandchildren are going to turn out better because we're privileged.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't
they're
going to
turn out privileged because they're privileged.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know quite what better means
yeah.
in that context.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, I mean,
but,
in whatever sense, aren't you lucky
mm-hmm.
to have these great grandkids?
Yeah.
I mean,
and
whatever respect society sees success
yeah.
in grandchildren.
Yeah.
We
yeah.
have the ability to make that happen, even though some of it may be luck or happenstance.
And I probably chose the wrong thing. I
yeah.
know. Just,
but I know what you mean, because you hear that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Your kids are so great or whatever.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, I think your point is a really important one about this assumption of zero sum. You know, that if you get something, I lose something. And that is, I think, the fear that keeps people in these rigid categories all the time. But somehow, it does mean change, right? It is going to mean that something changes, and that can be perceived as a loss, or it can be perceived as maybe even a blessing to have less or to be aware of what you have in a different kind of way. So maybe that is an important way of sort of shifting the discourse when you're in that conversation, is to be reminded, you know, this isn't really about a simple vision of haves and have-nots, such that if we try to get opportunity or more privilege in certain other directions, it's a lesser. But it will mean change. I mean, there is this problem of, you know, maybe the male candidate at Grinnell isn't going to get the job because somebody will say, how about we give the job to the woman? You know, and if you look at those exact specific examples, you might think, well, that guy needs a job just as much as anybody. Well, everybody needs the job.
Mm-hmm.
It just needs to be taken out of the conversation, these assumptions about gender in relation to money. So I think you're on to sort of a tangle in the conversation that is very easy to misrepresent and misunderstand. And I think maybe just being aware of that can help any of us in conversations like this.
I'll hold this table prayer, you know, give, you know, those with, you know, like, hunger for justice for those that have bread and bread
mm-hmm.
to those who hunger.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, it's a both and. It doesn't have to
mm-hmm.
be either or.
Yeah. Yeah, excellent point.
The other thing that occurs to me is, you know, partly because we talk about representation in government, and you know, we like people to represent us.
Mm-hmm.
But it's how often you hear people talk about, okay, you know, this community has 50% Hispanic, so there should be 50%. You know, it's like there's that percentage based on demographics
mm-hmm.
should apply
mm-hmm.
to both
mm-hmm.
workplaces, you know, I mean, or councils or whatever. I mean, I worked in a, you know, in a hospital, and we didn't have a lot of applicants of color. And they go, well, the population here is only 10%, you know, whatever.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And somehow that, I mean, I think we have a long ways to go. It doesn't matter, you know, where it doesn't matter, but you wonder how you, it doesn't matter what color you are, it doesn't matter what gender you are, it doesn't matter what sexual preference or have, whatever. But I'm wondering what that gap is of getting to the point where it doesn't matter, where
mm-hmm.
do you do representative, you know, should you have as many women bishops as men bishops because there's 50% women in the Lutheran Church? Or should you have more women? They really should have whatever people qualify or most qualified.
Yeah, there is, I think we're at a tricky moment historically because I think that many of us want qualifications, skills to be the only thing that matters, but there are a lot of really warped opportunities for gaining those skills. And it is true, I think any of these checklists ought to remind us that for people who are in a position of privilege, you can be ignorant of what other people need. You know, you can have great qualifications to be a bishop, but if your community is half Latino and you're white, you might not be the best representative. You might just not think about what the needs are of that constituency. In the same way that at least having someone you could have a conversation with on a regular basis within the decision making who will give you that eye, you know, until we're in a position where I can trust that any white straight man that I elect will think about gay people, think about people who are not white, will think about the underprivileged of any category. And we're not quite in a place where I trust that. So you know, I guess our question then, you know, in this, if we want concrete ideas about what to do, rather than sort of feeling like, oh, it's this weird invisible power thing, who made ideology, how do we unmake it, that can feel really disempowering. It's like, oh my God, we're kind of off kilter, and what can any of us do? But I do think we need to think then backward about things like access to education, about things like, you know, access to language skills so that we can communicate with one another. You know, we need to have more people who speak English willing to learn other languages that aren't English rather than assuming that everyone's going to learn ours. We need to sort of meet one another so that we can try to have conversations about here's what my life is like in a small town in Minnesota when I'm not white, so that we can, you know, meet one another somehow.
But part of that's back to acknowledging that I am privileged and that there are things I don't know about that privilege class and being willing to listen.
Yeah, getting over the embarrassment of saying, I'm sorry, this might be an awkward question, you know, but I am an idiot about such and such topic, you know, can you share with me?
Yeah.
And that's uncomfortable, you know. I know I never like not knowing something. And, you know, we all have different personalities about how we do with that.
But that also empowers the other person also, that they do have something you need.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think maybe that, you know, emphasizing in the question of the zero-sum game, if we realize that change is maybe not just a possible loss, but that shift of perspective offers us something, enriches us. You know, I know many of you were at the sermon on Sunday at the Eucharist service still, and this conversation about the wheat and the chaff and what's our job, to try to weed the garden ourselves or just to try to grow healthily ourselves. Part of the reasons that the bishop was giving us was because we need each other. You know, we learn how to be our best selves often via the people who are quite different than ourselves, not the people who are as ourselves, because we already know some of the same stuff, you know? And it's certainly great to have good friends or family members or whatever, people who know you well, that's a great source of information as well. But the things we don't know that we don't know are often the things we need the most. And so somehow, if we go into the world with that assumption, I don't know how it'll play out for each of you. You know, you have an empty board so far with what then can we do. But if you go into, you know, the rest of your day today and the rest of your future in your communities, thinking that it might be your task to sketch out a few ideas on that empty slate, you can, you know, I hope that we can feel empowered to take steps rather than feeling guilty over, you know, being privileged. It's easy to feel guilty and ashamed and, oh, you know, but that doesn't get us very far if we can frame our awareness of ways that we are privileged in such a way to open up conversation, offer to someone else the ability to explain themselves and define themselves. that will help move us in the right direction. We're out of time. We're over time. As usual.